Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On the program today, what happens to policy when the economic data doesn't work? We'll tell you about that. Why do airlines have such lousy computers? And we'll find you the intersection between cupcakes and Bitcoin. Seriously, we will. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by 23andMe DNA Kit, designed to provide over 200 personalized health reports and knowledge to make informed personal health decisions. Your DNA Kit is available at 23andMe.com/marketplace.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Wednesday, the 17th of April. Glad you could be with us. All right, so what would you do if I told you that the debate we've been having in this country the past, what, three-ish years or so over government spending, debt and deficits, in other words, was faulty, based on research that was questionable? That'd be quite something, right? Well, it might also be the truth. The data used in a highly influential paper by Harvard economists Ken Rogoff and Carmen Reinhart has been shown to have some problems. Tim Fernholz covers the economy for Quartz, the Atlantic Business Channel. Tim, thanks for coming in.
It's always a pleasure.
So what, in layman's terms, what was the mistake here that Reinhart and Rogoff made?
They made the most glaring error was a mistake in Excel. They had a spreadsheet with a lot of different countries' history on them, and they wanted to see how high debt affected their growth rates.
Yeah.
But when they calculated the final average, they left out five countries, and that changed things pretty significantly.
So this is like an Excel typo?
This is like an Excel typo.
Explain to me why it's significant, though, because this is a paper that was fundamental to this whole debate.
Absolutely. This paper came up with this idea that once a country's amount of debt is equal to 90% of its wealth—
yeah.
That country is going to have significantly lower growth, which means less jobs, less profit for everybody. And when we were talking about the budget deficit and the debt in 2011, 2010, 2012,
yeah.
Everybody had this 90% threshold on their minds.
From this paper?
From this paper. Hugely influential. The Senate Democratic budget chair, the House Republican budget chair, the U.S. Treasury secretary, Bowles and Simpson, the budget guys, everybody knew that debt was this big problem. But it turns out maybe debt wasn't the biggest problem after all.
Explain that a little bit.
When you're making choices about the budget, especially right after the recession,
yeah. It's
a cost-benefit analysis. The government can spend more money now to boost the economy, deal with jobs, things mm-hmm. like that. Or it can start to cut its spending and raise taxes so we borrow less money.
Mm-hmm.
And in the long term, economists think that having less debt is going to be better for the economy. But when you're coming out of a crisis, you have to make a decision then and there.
And that's what these guys said. Reinhart and Rogoff said, we have to decide now. We have to cut now.
They went to a meeting in April of 2011 where they met with 40 senators right before, 2 or 3 weeks before the government was going to shut down.
They got 40 senators in the same room?
It's a very challenging thing
right?
to do.
Yeah.
And they did it. And they told them, you need to act now. And that we can't afford to spend more money to stimulate the economy.
What do they say in their defense? Because it's, you know, this has been out there for, you know, 24 hours now.
Basically, they say that they are not the only people to find that high debt leads to low growth. But I think what they're missing and what a lot of critics have said is that this is really more of a correlation. And it's not clear if countries that are growing slowly have high debt or if high debt causes countries to grow slowly. And in macroeconomics, it's really hard to draw a straight line between any 2 points.
Well, let me pick up on that for a second, because there's some element of this that is macroeconomic sausage making, right? I mean, what economists do is they weight certain things one way, they discount certain things, they issue informed opinion, and then they come out with a model.
30 years ago, we probably wouldn't be talking about this. But why it matters is because when politicians in this country and, in fact, around the world were deciding what to do to save the economy after the recession, they were reading this paper, and it was scaring them, and it was making them think, we need to cut the debt now. if we want to save the economy.
The example that comes to mind, and I guess economists would call it a natural experiment, right, is the UK versus us the past 2-3 years.
Absolutely. And this paper was read in the UK too, and they went in two different directions. The government in the United Kingdom, after the recession, started raising taxes and cutting spending and really going on this austerity path, while in the US we had the stimulus bill and a much slower sort of track towards deficit reduction. And you've seen that in the UK, it's still a recession. They're still growing debt, while in the US we've had, you know, slow, uninspiring growth, but the unemployment rate is going down, and so is the debt actually.
Tim Fernholz, he writes for Quartz. Tim, thanks a bunch.
Absolutely.
Traders continued their volatile ways this Wednesday, third day in a row of triple-digit swings down this time. Details, numbers, you know the rest. In the Senate of the United States today, Republicans were able to filibuster an amendment to the gun control bill that's making its way through Congress. This one would have expanded the types of gun sales requiring background checks. Purchases at gun shows would have been included in the new rules. It would also have covered gun sales online. And as Marketplace's David Gura reports, that market has been booming the past couple of years.
Say I want to buy a Smith & Wesson M&P.
A small 9mm pistol. It's a low-capacity, 7-round magazine.
Patrick Shearer's got one for sale. He lives in Northern Virginia. He could go to a gun show or a dealer, but Shearer is using ArmsList, a website, he says, that's like Craigslist, full of classified ads, but for guns. It's one of the biggest online marketplaces for firearms. Roy Huntington edits American Handgunner magazine. He says sites like ArmsList took off after eBay banned gun sales more than a decade ago.
I don't have any numbers on it, but it's a huge presence in the marketplace.
There are sites for selling guns and trading guns. There are online auction sites just for guns. It seems the convenience of the web is not just for books and clothing. Garen Wintemute runs the Violence Prevention Research Program at UC Davis.
I think in some limited sense, online sales could make gun shows obsolete.
He says that at any given time, sites like ArmsList have tens of thousands of guns for sale.
Online, I don't need to wander around a building looking for what I want. I can search for it specifically without leaving my chair.
And when Patrick Shearer finds someone interested in that Smith & Wesson pistol, that transaction will take place in private.
Just like I would if I was going to sell something on Craigslist. We meet in a neutral spot that's convenient for both of us.
Shearer says he does more than what Virginia law requires. He asks for two forms of ID, and he makes the buyer fill out a bill of sale. But as with all online sales, no background check is required. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Should you have had the misfortune to be booked on American Airlines yesterday, we do hope you eventually got where you were going. Computer problems forced American to cancel more than 400 flights. It delayed hundreds of others. Thousands of people were stranded. And you may well be wondering at this point, hey, American, it's the 21st century, man. Where were the backup computers? Oh, they had them, but they failed too. Marketplace's Queen of Kim reports now on the sad state of airline computing.
So I should start by saying nobody really knows what went down.
American's not telling everyone exactly what happened.
Brett Snyder runs the blog crankyflyer.com. He says all we know is that the link between American Airlines and its reservation system known as Sabre went down.
And so American was unable to do a lot of things required for daily business.
Like call up its passenger list, print boarding passes, track bags, and it even helps calculate the weight of the plane. When an airline loses touch with its computers, it's basically brain dead. Joe Brancatelli is a publisher of JoeSentMe.com, a website for business travelers.
The Sabre system dates back to the 1950s.
Back then, few people flew, and most tests were done by hand. Brancatelli says to grow, the airline started to computerize. But since then, the number of flyers has exploded, airlines have merged, and the business has become incredibly complex.
Rather than scrap and start again, they are always upgrading, updating, changing stuff that was built in the 1950s.
And computer systems really start to show their age when airlines merge. A little more than a year ago, United and Continental teamed up, they merged their computer systems, and there was chaos for months. Brancatelli says, given what happened yesterday, if the American and U.S. air merger goes through, we could be in for a replay. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
We have now, with apologies to Mr. Dickens, a tale of two grocers. This is the worst of times for the British retail giant Tesco. Its annual profit has dropped a stunning 96%, due mostly to a failed foray here. Over the past 5 years, Tesco has opened 200 fresh and easy stores in the United States, targeting value shoppers, as they're known. It's officially packing up and going home as of today. But this is the best of times for Fairway, the New York grocery chain aimed at a higher-end clientele, went public today on the NASDAQ. Shares had a nice little bump. Diverging fortunes, perhaps, that speak volumes about American tastes in the food aisle. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has that story.
Tesco did its homework before launching Fresh and Easy. Secret test stores were set up. British executives lived with American families. The result? Low prices, prepared foods, and a complete misread of the American shopper, says analyst Phil Lempert.
They didn't really hear what was in the heart and soul of the consumer.
What is in the heart and soul of the American grocery shopper? Feeling important. Lempert says Fresh and Easy only had self-checkout, a big no-no for Americans.
The checkout experience is probably the most important experience that we have in store. We want to have a smiling face. We want to have some respect.
Also important to Americans, a hands-on experience, says supermarket consultant Kevin Koop.
We like to feel the oranges. We like to squeeze things. And they would have things pre-wrapped so you couldn't do that.
Years of research, efficiency, this couldn't be farther from the Fairway model, says Bob Golden with food research firm Technomic.
Well, some of their stores, you walk in, they're old, they're cluttered.
And they've got a wildly loyal customer base. Analyst Phil Lempert says Fairway's mix of familiar brands, specialty foods, and low prices is a winner.
You can buy your Bounty paper towels as well as some exotic coffee and really have an adventure. And that combination of value and adventure is absolutely dead on for the millennial generation.
The millennial generation being full of foodies on tight budgets. Fairway's betting on that. It plans to expand from 12 stores to 300. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
You know the cupcake rage of the past couple of years, nay, bubble, if one is cynical about it? All right, keep that in your back pocket and think about bitcoins, the cyber currency that's been quite bubblicious itself this past month or so. Now, you roll them all together, and what do you get? You get a cupcakery that takes bitcoins is what you get. Jennifer Longson owns Cups and Cakes up in San Francisco. Jennifer, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
So how often do you get people coming in the door saying, listen, I want to pay you in bitcoins?
Well, back in October when we first started, it was maybe once or twice a month, and now it's more like 3 to 5 times a week.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah.
How does it work? Do they wave their cell phone at your reader or something?
Well, we use an iPad as our register system, so we just bring up the BitPay app, and we type in how much they owe us. Up pops a QR code, and they scan it with their online wallet on their phone, and in about 30 to 60 seconds, it pops up that it's been confirmed.
Do you not have to worry about exchange rates and all that? It must make you crazy keeping track of how much bitcoins are worth.
Well, no, BitPay actually does that automatically. Wow. So I don't have to do any exchange rates. I just type in U.S. dollars how much they owe us, and it automatically converts it.
Now, you'll grant me that cupcakes and bitcoins are an unusual combination, yes?
Yeah, I suppose so.
So how did you get there?
Well, I'm in San Francisco, and I am married to a tech guy who loves Bitcoin and convinced me relatively easily, don't get me wrong, to start taking it. And it took about maybe 10 minutes.
How many Bitcoins do you suppose you have in the bank right now?
I have absolutely no idea. I don't keep track of how many we have.
Your accountant's going to have a chat with you about that, I'm sure.
Well, so here's the thing. Okay. I don't really count it as income because I don't ever really see it. It stays as Bitcoin, so I don't really spend it.
But your husband has the warm and fuzzy of knowing that he's doing this?
Exactly.
Not to cast aspersions here, but do you worry at all about the twin bubbles, the bubbles in Bitcoins and the bubble in cupcakes, perhaps?
No, I don't. So there's two parts to that. With the bubble in Bitcoin, everything's going to be sort of vaguely unstable. It's new, but I think eventually they'll stabilize out once people sort of use it more.
And the cupcake bubble, you're not so
and
worried
the cupcake
about that?
Bubble, I mean, the first cupcake reopened like 15 years ago. How is that a bubble?
I don't know. Houses have been around for a long time.
They have indeed. Well, I mean, my business is just as good as usual, if not better. And, you know, we're also a very small bakery. We haven't expanded. So there's two employees plus me.
If you were going to do a Bitcoin cupcake, what would it look like?
Well, we actually have done some Bitcoin cupcakes.
Man. That was a throwaway question. Are you kidding me?
No joke. Bitcoin cupcakes.
No
there
joke.
It is.
Jennifer Longson. She owns Cups and Cake Bakery up in San Francisco.
Yes.
Jennifer, thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
Coming up, 29 states have passed laws that don't let companies turn down smokers.
That means 21 do, you know, Freakonomics straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. The seesaw goes up, the seesaw goes down. The Dow Industrials gave back nearly all its gains from yesterday, dropped 138 points, almost 1%, 14,618 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ dumped 59 points, 1.8% today. Closed at 3204. The S&P 500 slumped 22 points, 1.4%, 1552 at the bell. Bank of America set the tone today with an earnings report that missed analyst expectations. Hate it when that happens. Shares retreated nearly 4.75%. Other financials followed suit. J.P. Morgan Chase ditched 3.5%. Today, Goldman Sachs off 2.4%. Not much better in tech stocks. Shares of Apple peeled off 5.5%. Hewlett Packard and Cisco Systems both powered down 2.5%. Yahoo stumbled 0.4% today after a drop in display advertising led to some disappointing earnings. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.70%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by 23andMe, a personal DNA kit so individuals can better understand how their genes impact health, which means individuals and their doctors find health areas to keep an eye on. 23andMe also gives ancestry information and helps discover global origins or perhaps find relatives. Available today at 23andMe.com/marketplace. That's the number 23andMe.com/marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Senate Armed Services Committee holds a hearing on threats to national security. The Conference Board releases its monthly index of leading economic indicators. And the annual Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony is held in Los Angeles. This year's inductees include Hart, Donna Summer, and Rush. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Parents of movie-going children everywhere, this next one is for you. The Motion Picture Association of America, the MPAA in the vernacular, is shaking up its rating system. There's still going to be R's and PG-13s and all that, just with more descriptions and bigger letters, because why would you mess with marketing success? Marketplace's Sally Herships explains.
For parents worried about their kids seeing too much violence or SEX at the movies, the Motion Picture Association says it wants to make things easier.
At the MPAA, we're dedicated to making sure every film finds its proper rating.
Of course, there's a trailer to let viewers know about the changes. When the new system kicks in, movies won't just say R for violence.
It might say something like R for thematic science fiction elements or, a scene of gory war violence or something along those lines.
Brett Lang writes for the Hollywood website, TheWrap.com. He says the changes are not a dramatic overhaul to the rating system. They're only cosmetic. A larger font and more detail about what's in the movie. Lang says it's likely the MPAA doesn't want to scare away crucial audience members or their parents.
PG-13 is the sweet spot for studios. Out of the 20 highest grossing films last year, only two of those films were rated R.
Yeah, well, that's why PG-13 is so important. It's teenagers.
Tom Adams is an industry analyst with IHS. He says PG-13 films brought in over half of the revenue from last year's box office, but PG-13 titles are only 14% of the market. The MPAA says the changes to movie ratings will take effect at a theater near you on May 1st. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
The phrase black market gets bandied about pretty widely. It's used to describe everything from the selling of human organs to counterfeit Louis Vuitton bags and some surprisingly common items as well. Tide laundry detergent is one frequently used example. Here's another one. A guy in New York was charged recently with stealing toner cartridges and selling them for a hefty discount. And in point of fact, some of the items you buy on a regular basis may actually have made their way onto the shelf through that black market. Marketplace's David Weinberg has that story.
Sea cucumbers are big on the black market. The endangered species is a delicacy in Asia. Old cell phones are another big seller in underground circles. Black market moon dust from Apollo 11 found its way to an auction house in Missouri. But one of the most common items on the black market is cigarettes.
It's a very significant amount of money, certainly many millions of dollars.
David Merriman is a professor at the University of Illinois, and he did a really creative study on cigarette smuggling in Chicago. He had his undergrads walk randomly selected neighborhoods and collect the discarded cigarette packs they found on the ground.
And on the cigarette pack is a tax stamp which indicates where it was purchased.
Merriman and his students found that 75% of the packs did not have Illinois stamps. Most had stamps from neighboring Indiana, which has a cigarette tax that's about $3 less than Illinois.
Look at New York State. We've estimated that 60% of the total market is illicit.
Michael Lefebvre is with the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. He researched black market cigarettes in New York, but he also found examples of other goods that were being sold to shoppers who had no idea they were stolen.
We have seen a very popular item, Sanilac. It's a formula for babies.
It's now common practice for wholesalers and retailers to lock up their supply of baby formula because it's so frequently stolen and sold on the black market. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every couple of weeks. We talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is the hidden side of everything. Dubner, long time no talk, man.
Great to be back, Kai. Thanks for having me.
You bet.
You trained as a Navy pilot, I know. I wonder if you ever thought about afterward working as a commercial pilot. Was that ever a plan?
Yeah, no, not really. That was never my thing. No.
Yeah. Well, if you had, and if you had interviewed with, let's say, Alaska Airlines, there's something you would have needed to know. Here's an airline spokesperson, Marianne Lindsay.
In general, there's a question that's asked, you know, have you smoked or used tobacco products within the last, I believe it's 6 months? And we go by how the employee responds to that question. And then before they are hired, they have a drug test that they take that detects nicotine use.
So Alaska Airlines would not hire me were I a smoker, yes?
Alaska Airlines would not hire you if you were a smoker. They've had this policy for quite a few years. More and more companies now are refusing to hire anyone who uses tobacco. A lot of healthcare firms, especially, and hospitals.
It has to be about cutting healthcare costs, right?
Right. That's a primary reason for sure. So smokers are more expensive than non-smokers if you're the company. By one estimate, about $4,000 a year in terms of healthcare and lost productivity and so on. But, you know, there's also the idea that you want to make every workplace healthier, which means, you know, smoke-free seems to be a good idea there.
Right. Okay, that makes sense. Question number two, though, Dubner, is this. Last time I checked, and I understand this is not a question. Last time I checked, smoking is legal, man.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And so can they do that?
Yeah, that's the question. Yes. So as it turns out, in terms of the legality of hiring smokers, 29 states have passed laws that don't let companies turn down smokers. Hmm. But the other 21 states do allow you to do that. So if I'm a company in New York or North Carolina or California, I cannot reject an employee because he or she smokes. But if I run a company in Pennsylvania or Florida or Alaska, I can. So that's It's a pretty severe split, which recently led to a piece in the New England Journal of Medicine about the ethics of not hiring smokers. Here's one of the authors, Zeke Emanuel, who's a bioethicist and a professor at the University of Pennsylvania.
I'm a cancer doctor. I find smoking disgusting. I find smoking horrible.
I wish that everyone who did it could quit.
All right. So it's not hard to think that he's in favor of not hiring smokers, right? But wait, there's more.
But I also recognize that it's not voluntary, that most people start before they're adults, and that it's incredibly hard to quit once you've started.
Okay, wait. Not voluntary? I mean, Zeke Emanuel's a smart guy and all, but huh?
Right. So that is really the basis of his argument, which is that most smokers want to quit but can't, and to refuse to hire them is therefore discriminatory or at least unethical.
Does this break down on socioeconomic lines? I mean, is there a low-income, low-wage worker versus high-wage, high-income person thing?
Yeah, that's a great question. So low-income people are substantially more likely to smoke than high-income people across the board. So if you're a low-income smoker and now you can't get a job because you smoke, it's sort of a double jeopardy. There's also the fact that smoking is one of those activities, legal, as you noted, but publicly frowned upon, that seems to open a bigger can of worms in terms of hiring. Here's Emanuel again.
Once you're on this kick, you can say, look, you know, those Seventh-day Adventists, they're the people we really want to employ, because those guys, they don't smoke, they don't drink, they eat very healthy, they don't engage in high-risk sporting activities. You know, that just seems to me exactly where we don't want to be going.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, Kai, you can imagine a future where nobody wants to hire anybody who does anything at all risky. Maybe not even risky, just expensive. Like, look, becoming pregnant, having kids, right?
That's right.
Because as we all increasingly share healthcare costs, that means that you increasingly are thinking about what I do because it affects what you'll pay in insurance and taxes. Now, in the case of smoking, what's interesting, it's really all about the incentives. In a tough labor market like ours, will it turn out to be that getting a job is such a strong incentive that it might help a smoker who's tried everything but everything else has failed? I have no idea if that will work, but it'll sure be worth keeping an eye on.
Stephen Dubner, Freakonomics.com is the website. Stephen, we'll see you in a couple of weeks, man.
Thanks so much, Guy.
Freakonomics Radio on Marketplace is co-produced by WNYC and is supported by Reputation.com, helping professionals and businesses look their best when people search for them online. Learn more at 1-800-REPUTATION. Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, a change at the top of the which is the biggest company in the world chart. Apple shares, as you know, if you've been paying attention during the numbers lately, have been sliding down another 5.5% today, close to $400 a piece. What that means for you and me, not so much unless AAPL is in your portfolio, retirement or otherwise. But in the market capitalization bragging rights contest, it bumps Apple back down below Exxon as the most valuable publicly traded company on the planet. And there you have it. We got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the program for us every single day. I'm Kai Rizdahl. What do you say? Tomorrow? Do it again? All right. Good. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.